Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Homefront, and I am so delighted we get an opportunity to be with our favorite people again for another episode. This is the greatest night. I have the greatest guest, and I've got Brent Stafford with me, the one and only Brent, who made St. Charles County famous a few months ago. Back in Brent, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Okay, well, you know, nobody's gladder than me because we go way back, Brent, and what makes you special is we didn't even know how famous we were going to become later. What happened, I don't remember, frankly, when we first met, but I believe I do.
Yeah. The first time I met you was at a homeowners association meeting. It was held in at the Civic Hall there in Civic Park. Is where our homeowners association meeting was, and that was back in, I think, 1993 or 1994. But that was the first time I met you at a homeowners association meeting, and
you were introducing
yourself to all the people here, and that was before the very beginning of the big building, with the building and all the new people coming.
Brent, I'm going to have to ask you to speak up a little bit more because your voice is a little muffled.
Okay, I'll try.
So we were at the Civic Hall, and did you like your subdivision? They took taking good care of you?
Well, not really. Homeowner association politics is almost worse than some of the real politics that goes on.
It's another level of government. It's all how do we choose to govern ourselves? And at the time, probably if it was 94, your developer still had ownership of the majority of it. Am I correct?
I think that was the meeting where we had just enough to actually elect our first people. And then, of course, as soon as they got elected, their interpretation of serving the neighborhood was to walk around with a clipboard looking for violations. And that's not quite the way I would have done things. But anyway, we go back. I guess that's about 20 years ago that I met you.
Almost 20.
But I didn't really get involved in O'Fallon politics until the Main Street Ventures thing. That's kind of what really kind of got me started in getting involved with government and politics and watching that. I don't believe in eminent domain for economic development purposes, and watching everyone really passionately fight that Main Street Ventures project, and I watched that on the city, cable channel throughout the process, and that's really kind of when I started getting involved in things.
And all governments tend to grow bigger with time. You leave them alone, and that was what the clipboard deal started with, is how can we grow our government bigger and make ourselves more important? And the same is true on every level of government. And then when it really came to a head was when I believe I was in the state legislature
and this is a few years later, and you were on the Parks Board, and you came to me and said that the Parks Board was doing something that wasn't right, it wasn't allowed by state statute, and what are we going to do now? And again, Parks Boards like to grow bigger and do more beyond sometimes what they're authorized legally.
What that was about was, this was all around the time when this was shortly after Main Street Ventures and the state audit of O'Fallon. And I wasn't on the Parks Board at that point, but the city ordinance matched, because at that time we were a fourth-class city, and I was a big part of changing us from being a fourth-class city. But we were a fourth-class city, which is what's called a statutory city, and which means we had to follow state law. And the way the Parks Board was structured, or the Parks Department or Parks Ordinance was structured, was to match the state law, which basically says that the parks, when you levy a tax, like the real estate tax, specifically for parks, that the Parks Board controls how to spend that. And for the entire time the Parks Board had been in existence to that point, the Board of Aldermen dictated how the parks funds were dealt with, and they were being intermingled with the general fund, the city's municipal general fund, and that was in violation of the state law. And I tried to bring that up, and that actually did get into the state audit report, and the Parks Board was reformed, once the Parks Board was reformed, that's when I was appointed to the Parks Board by the mayor at the time, Donna Morrow.
Nice. Well, and it's good, because what made you special is there is a need for people who understand the rules. And this is the odd phenomenon that occurs, is once people get on boards and commissions, they tend to do whatever the leadership tells them to do, because they trust that they obviously they know what's right, or they wouldn't have suggested this. And yet we need to ever be vigilant. We need to all know the rules. We need to all care about the rules and want to respect the rules. And just because you're the head of the corporation or the Parks Board or whatever it is, the city, it doesn't guarantee that you know everything. It just guarantees that you have the power to move the group in a different direction. And sometimes you might be getting bad advice. Probably they all were well-intentioned, but there's a point when they go off script, and that's why we have a constitution, because we know that rules are important.
Yeah, and absolutely, and I've been involved in a lot of different rules, and one of them we can talk about a little bit later was the whole caucus thing, and that was, because people didn't want to follow rules, but here in O'Fallon, back to some of my involvement, is as a fourth-class city, and you had actually at one point, I believe, tried to change the state law concerning fourth-class cities, but fourth-class cities do not have the power of initiative and referendum. And so if the typically they're called Board of Aldermen in a fourth-class city, if the Board of Aldermen doesn't really want to carry out the will of the people, they don't have to, and there's no recourse in a fourth-class city. And currently St. Peter's is a fourth-class city. Cottleville is a fourth-class city. Lake St. Louis is a fourth-class city. St. Charles City is actually a constitutional charter city, which is what I pushed for in O'Fallon. There was a brief time where we were a third-class city, which was a really ridiculous step. It was really pointless. We ended up putting it before the voters to adopt a charter commission, and I was on the commission and was one of the main ones to help draft the city charter. And I pushed for that for a number of years. So now O'Fallon is a constitutional charter city, and we have the ability to do initiative and referendum and recall. But we also defined basically the constitution of O'Fallon is what the charter is, and I was a big part of that. Now, I will say that I feel a little bit guilty, because the very first initiative was the smoking ban, and I opposed that because of my belief that violates people's personal property rights. But that was an example of people being able to do an initiative under the new charter.
And the reason the initiative started, even just to rewind the tape, is the city, as I said earlier in the show, all governments want to grow bigger. So the city fathers of O'Fallon sat down and said, I wonder how we can take over the trash hauling.
Oh, yeah, and, don't get me going on the trash.
Well, the trash hauling is not a necessary role of government. It was being provided by private contractors. So we had gone out for bids. Actually, when I first got elected to the Board of Aldermen, they had the way it worked, if you moved to the city and you want your trash collected, you open up the yellow pages and look down the list of all the trash companies, and then you call them on the phone and ask them if they want to provide you trash service. And that's how I did it, at least. I went with whoever had the best price. So they competed on price. I got my trash picked up. And back in those days, many of the trash companies, if a family was elderly and could not get their cart to the curb, or if they couldn't get everything in it, the trash companies would add an extra service. Some of them, if they, you know, needed to, would walk up to the people's garage and get the trash cart and dump it. We didn't have uniform trash carts, so some were big and some were small, but people tended to buy the trash cart that matched the demand of their family. So if you've got a lot of diapers and you buy a lot of prepared foods, you're going to get a big one. And if it's just an elderly couple, or if you're living alone, you might not get you get the smallest one you need. That's called free markets. That's how private sector takes care of something called supply and demand. It works every time. But anyway, well, O'Fallon wanted to grow government bigger, and that's what they did. They bought the deal. They wanted to do it, and that when we went to one hauler, that's when Rose Mack was on the O'Fallon Board of Aldermen, and she said, why don't we put it on the ballot? And indeed, the city of O'Fallon did put a question to the voters. This was when we were a fourth-class city, on the ballot, and the voters agreed to it. So they went with one hauler that the city contracted with. Then is when they wanted to do it in-house, and I said, well, let's put it on the ballot. And the city attorney said, nope, you can't. You're a fourth-class city. Uh-uh, not allowed.
Well, and a part of the problem with this, it's not that the city wanted to get into the trash business, but then they actually basically prohibited any private trash hauler from doing business within the city limits. And so basically the Board of Aldermen at the time gave the city a monopoly on a service that had been provided privately. And if I didn't like my trash provider, I had the option before to look for someone else. Now there is no option, and it's a government monopoly on that service, and you don't have an option. And if you don't like the service, it's too bad. You don't have anywhere to go. So yeah, and things like, you know, I had twice a week pickup, which was nice, and you could actually put stuff next to your bin, and they would pick it up. Now, if it doesn't fit in your bin, you can't. They won't pick it up. And so, you know, I know myself, and if it's with me, and I'm sure it's with most people here in town, is, you know, I got stuff that accumulates because it won't fit in my trash can, and I don't want to pay the exorbitant rates that they charge if you want, you know, something that picked up that won't fit. You know, so yeah, that's another example of government monopoly. You know, and that's a big problem.
But, you know, and this is actually even for people who live outstate and don't have the same issue with trash, watch out, it's coming, because governments tend to like to grow themselves bigger. That's just one of the rules. So if you don't, and it's not that it's a moral issue, it's truly none of their business. It's a financial issue, and it was handled by the private sector. So in general, we can all agree to this. If private sector is providing a service, leave it alone. Government should not do that. Government should do the things that only government can do, like build roads and bridges. That's something government can do. Administer justice. That's something only government can do.
And when it comes to building bridges, a lot of times government doesn't build the bridges. They contract that out to private sector anyway, but they just use the public funds to do it. You know, I'm a pretty big, you know, critic of government and definitely want to see more of, the powers restored to the people and things. But, you know, there were a few accomplishments that I've done here besides the charter that I'm pretty proud of. While I was on the Parks Board, I fought and initiated the it took a while to get people on board, but then when we did, we finally got it done, was building the inclusive playground here in O'Fallon, the first one. You know, I kept pushing for the new, we built two new playgrounds and while I was on the Parks Board, I kept, pushing for them to be, inclusive. And what they would do is put in a little ramp, and then that was what they considered to be inclusive. Well, if you're a kid in a chair or an adult in a chair and you want to, play, you basically, you'd go up the ramp and you have to crawl around the rest of the way, because the ADA, minimum of compliance, is a place where you can, it's called a transfer location, where you can transfer from your chair onto the equipment, but then the rest of the time you're like crawling, And so, a lady in O'Fallon had gone to the O'Fallon Parks Board before I was on it, wanting to build an inclusive playground, and they basically turned her down, and she built it out in Lake St. Louis. And I thought that was ridiculous. An O'Fallon mother,
Brent, I'm going to take a call because we've got somebody on the line, and you're fading away here. So let me take this call, and we'll welcome the caller. Thank you for joining us on the Homefront show tonight. How are you doing? We have a sleepy caller. That's okay. We will let you join us more in a minute. But, Brent, since we're waiting on our caller, let me talk to you about the caucus, because you and I got elected then to the Central Committee, and I just loved having somebody fair, open, honest, with integrity on the committee. And it was your first term, so that made it special because you were coming in with a fresh eye. And one thing I appreciated about you is you did understand parliamentary procedure, which is very important. And what happened there, we got everybody got sworn in, and as the chairman, I had my members coming to me saying, Brent isn't really a Republican, he's a libertarian. And I didn't know that there was a litmus test that they performed on people, but I never once heard you tell anybody you were a libertarian. Can you explain that one to me?
Well, sure, absolutely. Because, first of all, in my mind, there's what a lot of people call big L libertarian and small L libertarian, with the big L libertarian basically meaning you're a member of the Libertarian Party. But a libertarian is someone who believes in liberty. And I guess I would have thought that Republicans would like liberty. I would think most people like liberty. I think liberty brings everyone together, and that's what our founders were all about. That's what the Declaration of Independence was about. So I would definitely call myself a libertarian, but I'm not a member of the Libertarian Party. I'm a member of, we don't have party membership in Missouri, but I'm a Republican and I vote Republican. But I'm basically a libertarian in the same vein as Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, you know, when he was campaigning for Barry Goldwater. So I'm a Goldwater Republican, and actually to bring it into current terms, I'm a Ron Paul Republican. So I think that was the biggest problem people had, was that I, you know, was a supporter of Ron Paul, and that's where the shenanigans came in at the caucus, is they were specifically trying to target people who supported Ron Paul.
Well, here's the part that is amazing. Why does the pendulum, when, you know, you look at the big tent idea and we're trying to grow the party, why does the tent only swing to the left and it never swings to the right? Why don't the people on the left end of the spectrum in the Republican Party get treated with the same level of disdain and uninvited behavior? And why aren't we looking at them cockeyed and saying, you're not really a Republican, you're really a lefty? We're not doing that. In fact, if you remember when we were on the Central Committee, there was the funeral protest idea that came up. And the committee, these are Republicans now who believe in limited government and supposedly believe in the Constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of thought, all that good stuff. And so here we are trying to make sure we're being, you know, fair to everybody and living with the Constitution. And why is it that during that difficult time we're waiting and planning on people being fair and honest, and they're saying, yeah, but we shouldn't have our freedom of speech if it's in certain locations for certain reasons? And as you can see, I felt at the time like you and I were kind of in a minority, because it's not that hard to figure out. The tactic of the left is to find a way to make it so that they'll find some extreme example to get us to give away our rights. And you're seeing that with Sandy Hook now. They found an extreme example to make us say, yeah, I guess they have a point. So you're even watching Republicans wondering if the Bill of Rights should really apply to us anymore today. And this should scare the bejeebies out of us, because it wouldn't be that bad if it were the Democrats who were saying, let's take away people's rights. But when Republicans are saying, let's do that, then maybe we're in the minority.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I don't believe in free speech zones. I, you know, the entire country, anywhere I am, is a free speech zone, okay? The types of protests at the funerals that particular group is doing is disgusting. I don't agree with what they were doing. But I don't think that saying, well, you can do it, but you have to be way over there. Because what happens is it's okay, you don't like what they're saying, but then when you have something that you believe in, and, you know, you can be told that, okay, you can't protest in front of this government building or in front of this political event. You have to do your protest, you know, a mile away.
That's where the free speech zone is. I mean, at these Democratic and Republican national conventions, the protest areas were the target of audience was. So free speech zones, I'm absolutely opposed to. I don't, you know, you always hear, you know, that the First Amendment is not to protect, you know, speech you agree with, but speech of all kinds. And so,
right.
You know, that's the thing. And when you start trying to use
Okay, Brent, I'm not hearing you any longer.
Okay, I don't know. Can you hear me better now?
You sound wonderful. Continue,
okay.
Please.
So when someone tries to get the government to, impose their views, that's force. That's tyranny. That's no longer liberty. There has to be a respect of other people's beliefs and opinions, and you cannot legislate your belief systems on people. Now, the way you get people to act or believe the way you want is through, you know, debate and discussion and force of your position, you know, in education, you know, to try to put laws in place that dictate how someone else should act. That is completely contrary to the whole idea of liberty. So
right.
The founders wanted liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Liberty is throughout those documents. That, you know, I'm a libertarian in the spirit of liberty, like Thomas Jefferson was.
Well, the other thing about the funeral protests is there already is a private sector solution, and that is the Patriot Guard that shows up, people on motorcycles, and they completely block the protesters from having access to disrupt the funeral. And I think that's magnificent. We don't need more laws. We have a way to fix our own problems. It's empowering. It is even better than coming up with new laws. I don't want to see police officers spraying mace on people and escalating it into a big ugly. I want to see my people, the citizens, rise up and be strong and be brave and say, shame on you. Get out of here. This is our funeral.
Here's something interesting, too. They passed a law recently that you are not allowed to protest, and I forget the distance, but it's some ridiculous distance, anywhere where there's Secret Service, okay?
Yes.
So if you're out on the street and you're protesting and the president drives up, now you're in violation of the law because you're too close. We are supposed to have the right to assemble and address our grievances to our government, and they say, no, you can't be close to us. And you know, what happens now with, you know, people are wanting to protest, you know, what's going on with the Second Amendment, but now, you know, they can't go to the person who's actually the one trying to violate it because they'll be arrested because they're protesting too close. You know,
right.
These are the things that they're putting in place.
Let me talk to you about the Fourth Amendment, because this is really upsetting to anybody who has to travel on the airplanes, wondering why am I having my search of my privacy? Why are they searching me without a search warrant? And to get a search warrant, you need to have some reasonable suspicion that somebody's guilty of a crime, meaning if a passenger is about to get on a plane and he appears to have a profile or fit, like he or say things, he might blow it up or something, then that gives you a good reason to get a search warrant and search him.
Well, this comes back to the private sector versus government, because prior to the TSA, the airlines, it was their responsibility to maintain your safety. You know, they had liability issues, and they had a responsibility. And you, as an individual, if you didn't like whatever security procedures they were putting in place, you didn't have to fly with them. But now they got the government that comes in, and they basically tell these people that, no, you can no longer provide your own security, we're going to take that over. And now you have the government, who is bound by the Constitution and by federal laws on what they can and cannot do, and they are overstepping those bounds. You know, there is, you know, the what is can only be described as assault is taking place at our airports by the TSA to touch people's genitals. In the way that they do, if anyone else did it, they would be arrested. That would be sexual assault. And for them to be able to do that and have the color of law and be immune to prosecution is just another example of government overstepping and the descent into tyranny that we see. You know, right now, there is a war on liberty going on. The war on terror. We saw the Patriot Act come from that, which is a gross violation of our Fifth Amendment and Fourth Amendment rights. against unreasonable searches and seizures, and you know, these warrantless wiretappings, and that, you know, you find out now that they have a record of every email ever sent is kept. So every email that you've ever sent since you ever had an email address is on record. You know, that is overstepping. You know, we've got drones in the air that can see through your walls. You know, and not only that, they can carry weapons, and you know. So, you know, if you got a drone flying over your house that can see through your walls and see you in your house, that's, you normally have to have a warrant for that. And we do have a state legislator that's trying to make that where you have to have a warrant. But we see this incredible acceleration of a police state and the government, you know, just going, you know, out of control and trying to be a part in you know, in every bit of our lives, and it's got to stop. And I think the Second Amendment issue, it may be the line in the sand. And we'll have to see what Obama does tomorrow with his executive orders. Supposedly 19 executive orders that he plans to issue tomorrow relating to the Second Amendment. And I think that's going to, and you see states now across the country that are basically saying they're not going to allow them to be enforced. You see, actually, there was a police chief in Pennsylvania that was trying to make a municipal ordinance that their city would protect the Second Amendment rights of their residents. And I've actually talked to one of our city councilmen about a similar ordinance here in O'Fallon. But, you know, and we could talk about the caucus and all that, and that was a bad thing. But right now, the rush into tyranny that we are seeing cannot be underestimated, and it's really pretty serious.
Well, I still write a weekly newsletter, and I wrote one a few weeks, well, actually a while back, about the TSA and why that's not right. I happen to get checked out more than most people. I believe my averages are pretty bad, but it's because I don't wear pants. So if you're wearing a skirt, they're imagining all kinds of devices that I might be hiding. A state legislator is really going to be doing this, right? So anyway, it seems every time I go through the airport, they do things that are purposely humiliating. They'll yell out loud, "We need a female search over here." And I'm like, guys, do you have to make a big scene over this?
Well, they do. They absolutely do, because it's a part of intimidation to the person that they're doing it to, and it's indoctrination to the people who are watching it happen. And
right.
this is desensitization of the public to this invasion. You know, people don't like to compare things to Nazi Germany, but how do you not, when you see what's going down with this, basically TSA is the brown shirts, you know, because you see, you know, papers, please, you have, you know, that's what's happening, and you see that more and more on there's these checkpoints around the country. The TSA is not just in the airports anymore. The TSA is at bus stations, train stations. They've set up in Tennessee. There's four main highways in and out of Tennessee, and they set up checkpoints at the border on each one of these highways, and basically you had to go through a TSA checkpoint to get in and out of Tennessee. I think they did it for a week or so. This is a year or two ago. TSA is Obama's civilian police force, as big and as well-funded as the military. He said that when he was campaigning in 2008, that that's what he wanted, and that's what he has. And it's only getting bigger. The Department of Homeland Security is not – they're about control. They are absolutely about control, and you know, it's just going to expand, and the TSA is a big part of that.
And the scariest part about it is that even though the informed citizens understand what's going on, most people don't. And I do get different levels of investigations at the airport because they, you know, it really depends on who you get. And I always warn them I'm ticklish before they start on me, but, you know, I can't help it. If I, it just makes me laugh. But here's the point. When I wrote my newsletter on the TSA and what's wrong with them violating our rights without a search warrant, they actually, I was surprised at how many of my constituents wrote me back and said, well, that's the price we have to pay for safety. And I wanted to say, wait a minute, no, that's not making us safer, and that's not the price we have to pay. They're conning us into giving away our rights. And I my point is that this should horrify all of us, that we are in a position now where the citizens are allowing this to happen. Because if we really didn't want to allow it to happen, we would have elected people to office who would have put a stop to it, and we're not seeing any of that. Same with Obama's executive orders that he's pushing, and wars that are not declared by Congress. If this Congress wanted to be brave enough to say, no, man in the White House, we don't do that until it's declared by us. Let's get this thing straight. They're not standing on their constitutional right to declare a war, and the whole country is suffering for it.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, these people, you know, they'd say, well, that's a price we pay to be safe. Well, these undeclared wars, these international entanglements, these, you know, going in and using drones, you try to kill one person and you kill 100. We're flying drones in countries where that we have not, like you said, declared war on, but we're killing their people. That is making us less safe. That is what's creating people that hate us. You know, there's security and there's defense, and then there's the actions that the government takes that creates these things, and it's been going on for decades and decades. You know, our involvement in other countries and creating, you know, toppling governments and putting in our puppets, and then things go south, and then we have to go in and topple them again. Now, we created Saddam Hussein. You know, installed the Shah. You know, we created a lot of these problems. But when you know, if you had your child killed or maimed by a drone attack, that's not going to make you love America. That's going to make you a militant against America. And it's these constant, foreign entanglements that we're getting ourselves into that, and again, they're not declared wars. You know,
and the Congress is letting them do it. I think the most offensive part, even with this gun issue coming up, is the knowing that the Republicans are in control of the House is a showstopper for anything bad going on, or it should be, but it's not. And when we watch them raise the debt ceiling again and come up with a new deal to stop the fiscal cliff, and we're all losing our shirt over it, that, you know, I'd like to see the legislators have to pay for the debt out of their own pockets because that
sure
would sober them up quick. Now,
well,
I would like to... Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, people may say, well, you know, these people, they're bad, they hate us, they're our enemies. You know, terrorists do not represent a country. They are criminals. They are they're murderers. If we had an American who was a murderer, and we know this guy's a murderer, we don't blow up the church he's sitting in at the time. There he is. He's in church. And we blow up the church and kill everybody. We don't do that. We target the one person. We go after the one person. We don't kill, you know, people all around him, you know, and you know, you see these people who have done nothing to deserve the death and the mutilation that they are subjected to, and we expect them to love us for it. It's pretty sick, and I wish people would understand that we're not doing ourselves any favors, you know, we had a constitutional remedy to Bin Laden, and it wouldn't have taken the billions or trillion dollars and all the lives of American soldiers and all the innocent people who were killed as collateral damage. There was a constitutional remedy, and that's called a letter of mark and reprisal. That's in the Constitution. That's what we use against pirates, against individuals that were basically an enemy of the country, an enemy of the state. And what that is basically is you put a bounty out on the person, and then you sit back and wait for somebody to go after it. We could have saved so many lives and so much money. We said there's $1 billion bounty on Bin Laden. How long do you think it would have taken for Bin Laden to be killed or turned in for $1 billion? It wouldn't have taken very long. And we would have saved money and lives doing it, and we would have done it through the Constitution.
Well, I don't like violence. I think we need to focus on what's right and honorable. But let me talk to you about money for a minute, because all this stuff is really draining us quick, and we can't afford too much. My son, though, came home from school today, and I said to him, "Young man, what did they do in school?" And he said, "We talked about money," but this is him for real. This is his education. He said, "But it wasn't real money. We just used fake money." And at that point, my husband said, "All our real money is fake money anyway."
That's right. Yeah. People, they really, most people do not understand what money is. What that piece of paper in their wallet or their purse or their pocket really is. They don't understand what constitutional money is versus corporate money or corporate currency, which is what we actually have. And it's the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve Act that was from 1913 is actually, I think, proposed it passed on the Christmas or Eve or something. But at any rate, that was basically where a private banking association took over monetary policy from the country, and basically the country turned over the treasury to the Federal Reserve. We actually, as a country, we gave them all of our money, and then we basically asked for it back at interest, or let them create money out of thin air at interest. So, there
is, lazy motherfucker. Fuck you.
Do we have a caller on the line who'd like to talk to us?
I don't know who that was, but.
Okay.
But at any rate, this is kind of a good segue, because this weekend, actually, there's it's a forum on Missouri economic prosperity, and monetary policy is going to be a big part of that. And talking about what real money is, and trying to establish a way for Missourians to deal with real money. And in the Constitution, money is gold and silver. People think we can't go back to a gold standard, but that's constitutional money is gold and silver. And so in Utah, they have they passed a law that basically allowed people to put U.S. minted gold and silver into accounts that they could basically use as any other bank account. And Paul Kirtman has a bill that he's putting forward to do the same in Missouri. So there's a forum on Missouri economic prosperity that's going to get really in depth with this. And Thomas Woods from Ludwig von Mises Institute is going to be the keynote speaker. But Ed Martin, who's the new chairman of the Missouri Republican Party, he's going to be there. Jim Lemke, Ann Zare, John Bruner, who ran for U.S. Senate, will be there. There's a man named Doug Jaden, who's with the 10th Amendment Center. I know you know a lot about the 10th Amendment with states asserting their rights, and the man who basically created the depository in Utah for their sound money, Craig Franco. He will be speaking at this. And the current speaker of the Missouri House, Tim Jones, will be actually the MC and moderator for the event, and that's this Saturday. That's going to be I'm trying to find the location for it here to let everybody know, but if you just look up Forum on Missouri Economic Prosperity, you'll find out more about it. I think I've got the address here now. It's at 1 o'clock at the Midwest Music Conservatory. It's 15977 Clayton Road in Baldwin. So I would encourage anyone that's really interested in knowing more about monetary policy and the role that the Federal Reserve has had in basically destroying our country, because the dollar is now worth about 5 cents of the dollar when the Federal Reserve took over. Before the Federal Reserve, prices had been pretty stable for since the founding of the country. It's a silver dollar, literally a silver dollar, bought the same thing in 1910 as it did in, say, 1850, pretty much. It was, but once the Federal Reserve got involved, they threw inflation, and people think inflation is just prices going up. No, inflation is really the value of the dollar going down. And what you have is not a dollar, it's a Federal Reserve note, and a note is a signature of debt. So what we have is debt money. We don't have real money. And so the more debt they create, and we see the government continue to raise the debt ceiling, what does that mean? That means the Federal Reserve creates more money, and that devalues the money we have, and that causes inflation. And it's at an astronomical rate. So the value of the dollar now is less than 5%, or around 5% of what it was in 1912. And if you look at you take a coin that's a silver coin, a silver quarter from, say, 1964, that silver quarter will buy just about the same thing it bought in 1964, because the value of silver is pretty much the same, but the dollar, that's, the silver is like $31 an ounce now. It takes more of these less valuable dollars to buy that same 1 ounce of silver. But that same ounce of silver, I think, or not an ounce, but a quarter is about $12. And that'll buy you, about 4 gallons of gas. It's about what it bought you in the 60s. So,
And then there's the whole tie of the dollar to oil. Right now, the only thing giving the dollar any value is that oil can only be traded in dollars. That was a deal that was post World War II, and that they made the deal, and the OPEC nations basically signed on that internationally only dollars can be used to buy oil. So the Chinese, the Russians, the Europeans, everyone in the world has to maintain some amount of dollars in order to buy oil.
Well, that's beginning to change. There's a big push to take oil away from the dollar, and a lot of countries don't want to use dollars to buy oil anymore. As soon as the dollar is detached from oil, there is literally nothing that's backing it anymore, and that's where we're going to see massive inflation coming and what's called hyperinflation. When the day that we don't purchase oil in dollars, that's pretty much the end of the dollar.
What I understand is Ben Bernanke is keeping the interest rates very low, artificially low, because if they went up to the true historical average, it would automatically escalate the national debt beyond what would be sustainable, although we're already unsustainable, I would say. But you look at what's going on, and I've consulted with several economists to try and get a grip on it, because most people, all they know is when they go to the grocery store, you can't buy ice cream in the full-size half gallon anymore. Most of it is cheating you out of at least one bowl at the end of it. And that's most people just see that the prices for food is going up, and we feel the price of gas. But it's very hard to find something relatable. And what I love about Tom Woods is I've heard him speak many times before, and he has a way of boiling down these complex economic issues to a way anybody can understand it. And I have a bookstore, and I have his book, 33 Questions. And if anyone has not read it, can I encourage you to read it? Because he writes it in a very forthright manner, in a way we can all get it, in a way that makes so much sense. And I'm convinced what's wrong with America is people quit becoming informed and educated. But you are a blessing to me. I am so glad that you could put the conference together and help people. There is a better way. There is a way for all of us to learn, to observe, to get better. We don't have to keep letting them shove their pablum down our throats and we take whatever big government wants to give us. There's hope because we still can self-educate.
Well, and just to be fair, I'm not the one putting on the conference. I'm a part of a group that is putting on the conference, and there's other people that are taking the lead on the organization of the conference and the speakers and all that. I've kind of let them take the reins on that one, and I've had other things taking up my time, but the St. Charles County Liberty Project is basically the group that's putting this on, and I'm not going to take credit for organizing it or putting it together. There's other people that are working hard to put it together, but I do think it's important for people to learn these things. We're in a time where we have access to information. We may not have it much longer, because they can take down the internet whenever they want. Search engines can scrub search results, so you can't find things that are out there. You can't believe the media that you see on television because it's all they all have their own agendas. But we do have the internet still right now, and people can go out and easily learn these things. And you've got to take an interest. This is not just something that you elect your person and you go back to sleep. The time for sleeping is over. Everyone needs to be awake right now and educate themselves on what's going on, because what's coming, it doesn't look good.
Thank you, Brent, because I'll tell you, I like the fact that it's never been easier to educate ourselves because we do have the internet. So, if you were to back up 20 and 30 years ago, then, yeah, you could say, well, people just didn't know. And today there are more resources than ever. And that's what I love, is the idea that we can pull together. We can be bigger than this. We can strengthen ourselves. And that's why we have the Blog Talk Radio, because it's all coming together. There are people who want to help, who want to make things better. When I first got elected to the O'Fallon Board of Aldermen, I went to many conferences where they tried to tell the elected officials this is how it works and this is what it is and that's all there is to it. And what was very empowering was when I would pick up the phone and try and call somebody who's an expert to find out if there's any other way around it. Well, that's the American spirit. That's what makes our country more free than other countries, because the vehicle is already in place for us to take it back, for us to get control again. Unfortunately, we're after a big election, because elections are the easiest time to affect change. But as you know what, there's always another election coming around the corner, and these are questions that must be asked of elected officials on all levels. And the municipal elections are coming up in April. Ask your people, what do you know about questions that are important to you? That's the only way we'll have accountability. When we were going through the trash hauling mess in O'Fallon, I remember one of the other one of my colleagues on the board was kind of angry with me and wouldn't even walk down the same hallway with me. And I sensed she was upset, and I said, "Cheryl, why are you so angry?" And she turned around and said, "Thanks to you, I've had to spend hours on the phone with my constituents." And what she was really saying is I raised some questions about the city foisted trash hauling program. The constituents realized there was a problem because one out of seven is asking questions now, and they had some direct interaction with their elected officials. And that's beautiful. That's how it should be. And if you don't want to spend hours on the phone talking to your constituents, then don't put your name on the ballot.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing I like about local government is you can, as an individual, can have a massive impact on your community just by going to the meetings and speaking on issues that are important to you. You can have a very real and direct impact on your community. I got fluoride removed from the water in O'Fallon, because no one knew about the issue. I brought it up, and it was actually fairly easy to get it gone. So O'Fallon is no longer having hydrofluorosilic acid, which is a industrial waste product, put into our water. So you know, definitely local government is a place you can have a big impact. If you don't you know, want to learn about monetary policy and the Second Amendment is important to you, this Saturday at the state capitol, at state capitals across the country, people are going to protest these incursions on our Second Amendment around the country. So you know, if you're a Second Amendment person, and consider going to Jefferson City to join with the thousands of other people to let our legislators know that they need to stand against the federal government on this. This is another area that's very clear. The Constitution doesn't allow this to happen, even at the federal level. So the states need to back up the people on this and draw that line in the sand on this issue. So either go and learn about economic policy and monetary policy and what real money is and how the Federal Reserve is not a good thing for us, or go to Jefferson City and stand, for the Second Amendment but definitely people need to get involved. It's not time to just sit back and watch American Idol anymore. You know, people need to really take some responsibility for what's going on in their lives and in their government.
Well, I appreciate that encouragement, and I also hope to see you this weekend. There, it sounds like there are going to be plenty of good people there, and that's our strength. It's sitting back in the armchair, wringing our hands, isn't going to work. It's time to find a better way. I moved here from Boston 28 years ago, and the first thing I noticed when I got to Missouri is what a great state this is, because people do love their freedom. And we're going to hang on to that. That's what makes us special. Missouri has a fierce, bold, and independent streak where people are empowered to say, that's the line, folks. Let's make it better. I'm proud of all of you.
I actually saw it was a rating of how free states are. And Missouri was actually number 4 or 5 in overall freedom, and it went down with economic freedom and gun laws and various different areas, taxes and things. In some areas, you know, we were even higher than 4th or 5th in specific areas. But overall, I think we were number 4 or number 5 in the nation on this freedom index. Wyoming and South Dakota, I think, beat us out, and maybe one other place. But we do have a very strong liberty sentiment in Missouri. I think we just need to build on that and act on it.
Well, thank you for that word of encouragement. I know we're coming up to the end of our very quick hour, and it really is great to have a chance to network and be together and encourage each other, because that's what it's about. How are we going to make it better except staying together? So this has been another edition of Homefront. Thank you, Brent, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.